Hello, listeners of the Mad Scientist Podcast. I am your host, Chris Cogswell, here for a special holiday episode here with a show and two hosts that I absolutely love, the Dirty Bits Podcast. I am joined right now by Tawny and George Plattis. Guys, how you doing?
Hi, we're doing great. Thanks for having us.
Doing good over here. No Thanks problem. For having us on the show.
Yeah, hey, I am glad that we finally got around to having you on. I think I started listening to your show after I first heard about it through the podcast we listened to Facebook page, right? Which, listeners, if you're not on that Facebook page, which I'm sure many of you are, jump on there and check it out. It's really great. But yeah, I absolutely love your guys' show. The Dirty Bits Podcast, for those that don't know, part of the Orbital Jigsaw Network and part of a Podience group, right? That's what you guys are doing right now.
Yes, right now we're doing the Orbital Jigsaw Podience group, which is a group that is for podcasters that want to learn how to monetize, advertise, basically grow it into something sustainable. And then if you're a listener, it's going to bring you in to show you all of these very high quality, carefully curated podcasts. You can get behind the scenes access. You can find out everything about the world of podcasting. And we're trying to kind of bridge that gap for those that are listeners and podcasters who are kind of on that like intermediate level. So it's really exciting. It's connected with the Orbital Jigsaw Network, which is what we're a part of.
Very cool. And you guys have been a part as well of a podcast survey that I actually took a little while ago, I think. And I've been seeing it all over the place. So if you know, what we'll do is we'll put that up on the website as well and on the Facebook page and everything for everyone to go check out. But tell us a little bit about your show.
Thank you so much. Our show is called the Dirty Bits Podcast, as we discussed. And what I do with my husband is we retell the scandalous, sexy, salacious stories from history that your teacher probably left out. So it kind of delves into all those little details that may have gotten skipped over in high school that actually make history a lot of fun. We're about to release season 2 coming up here on January 2nd, and it's going to cover old Hollywood.
Very cool. Oh, old Hollywood. Jeez. There should be plenty of salacious stories there.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. That we picked that topic before everything about new Hollywood started coming out. So,
oh, my God, like, oh, yeah.
But we have we came up with a disclaimer, and there was a lot we had to do after that happened because we were halfway through the season.
Yeah, it's going to It's interesting. It's going to be a little bit different. It's still very comedic, but it definitely delves into more of why Hollywood is the way it is and how early that began with the secrecy and the cover-ups. And so we definitely do explore that, but it is still funny.
Yeah.
Well, of course. Yeah.
We keep it on the lighter side.
We try.
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Oh, awesome. Well, I'm super excited for it. I actually really liked, I think probably my favorite episode that you guys did was on Genghis Khan.
Oh, thank you.
I really liked that one a lot. No, no problem. It's funny. I had heard this, you know, like you read Game of Thrones and you're mm-hmm. like, oh, it's supposed to be Genghis Khan. Like, whatever.
Totally.
You don't realize like it is like that's literally what it was like. Right? Like if he had a dragon and a wife that just like, you know what I mean? Like, it would have ended up exactly as Westeros ended up.
Oh, absolutely. We're watching Game of Thrones because we're both such history buffs, which is, you know, why we do the Dirty Bits. We're watching like Khal Drogo as he pours the silver over the head of Danny's brother, and we're like, that like happened.
Yeah. Right. That was legit. That actually occurred.
The Mongolian leaders at the time did that.
Yeah. No, it's totally badass. I mean, you never realize too, like, you never realize fully. So one thing that's kind of been interesting is seeing after Game of Thrones came out, like, just a huge swell in books that were like, you know, this is the time period that Game of Thrones is really based off of, right? It's like the War of the Roses or the War of the whatever. You know, and it's one of those funny things where it's like it has a lot of similarities to a lot of different eras mm-hmm. and a lot of different timelines. So you can put it on everything. But Khal Drogo is just like, you know, Genghis Khan better sue somebody.
Right.
You know what I mean? They just stole his fucking whole thing, man. Like,
yeah, totally. It's a big mishmash of history, I think.
It really is. Like, we watch it and we notice the same thing. It's so funny that you say that. We're huge Game of Thrones fans, and people try to say it's like, oh, it's all about the War of the Roses. And it's like, well, yeah, part of it. You know,
right. Like, yeah. It's, yeah. Yeah, a little bit of War of the Roses, a little bit of Roman, you know, like I Claudius style kind of stuff, a little bit of, you know, ancient India, like it all ends up getting kind of rolled up in there.
Totally.
Oh man, so good. So what we were doing for this episode, dear listeners, is I thought who better to talk about some of the more, salacious, sexy, ridiculous stories of the history of science than these two over here. So that is what we are going to do. I don't know. Do you guys want to start here with your story?
I'm happy to. I am just so jazzed to talk about Schrodinger's polyamory.
All right, let's do it then.
Okay.
He was a philandering philosopher.
He was he philosophy? I guess yeah. Schrodinger's cat.
Listen,
yeah,
at a certain level of science, you end up all being philosophers and scientists at once. So.
Yep.
It's fine.
Oh, yeah.
I'm like a little out of my element here, I must say. Like, you are both far more educated than I am. George was a philosophy major. He was in pre-law. You are, you know, educated to like the point of me not even being able to understand it because I didn't go to college. So I'm not even sure what everything means that you've done. So I'm like, I don't even know what that all means, all those degrees and everything. So.
Listen, I was a philosophy undergrad as well.
Oh,
you were?
So
oh,
George,
nice.
we're on the same wavelength there,
awesome.
Man. Yeah,
awesome.
Yeah, a lot of philosophy of science. That was what I originally when I went to school, I wanted to be a theoretical physicist until I realized that meant being like a physicist without any money. Right? Like basically, those positions are like you become a professor or you start working on stuff that can be turned into weapons, and those are like
right.
The only options. And I was like, well, I'll go into engineering then instead. You know, I'll just be into philosophy as like a side thing. And so actually, my podcast is like my love letter to the philosophy I didn't get to do.
Aww.
You know, it's kind of like it's kind of my attempt to. Branch out of science, but no, please come on.
I had a very similar experience. It was like after 2 years, it's like, yeah, no one really is gonna care about epistemology. I have to like figure out a way to make money with this. And it was like, okay, well, I can do ethics and have that be pre-law. So
right.
So
yeah,
begrudgingly,
that was, it was so funny in our philosophy department. We had the few students who were there just for like pure philosophy who ended up going to get like their PhDs and stuff and are now becoming professors, like, and those people, you know, just super jealous of like, damn. And then you had like
right.
The 85% of us who were doing philosophy because we loved it, but knew we couldn't make any money off of it. So it was like a lot of those people now are like, you know, biologists or lawyers or doctors or, you know. Middling podcast host. So, it's chill. It's like, you know, it worked out great.
Yeah.
Anyways, all right. So, Erwin Rudolph Joseph Alexander Schrodinger, one of my favorite scientists.
That's the one. The one and only. So, this guy was big deal, huge Nobel Prize winning Austrian physicist. He develops all these like fundamental results in quantum theory. He forms the basis of wave mechanics. He proposes this completely original interpretation of the physical meaning of wave function. He's the author of all these books, papers, articles in all these fields of physics, like statistical mechanics, thermodynamics, color theory, which, as we know, I don't understand, Chris. So what is color theory? Do you know?
So, color theory is basically the idea of, how do we perceive color,
mm-hmm.
right? And so, it's a really interesting field of it's now become more of a catch-all kind of idea where it's called, not necessarily supervenience, but almost this idea of, like, okay, how do you break up colors? So, colors, in some sense, are a quantized unit, right? So, in other words, you have red, you have green, you have blue, you have yellow, purple, whatever. Like, you know, you have red. What are the primary colors? Red, blue, yellow.
Right.
Yes.
Right. So those primary colors can then be mixed together to make or red, green, blue,
red,
basically.
Yeah.
Can be mixed together to make all other colors. right? Different versions of those along with black and white, you know, the brightness can be mixed together to make the full spectrum of colors. And so color on a physical scale is just wavelengths of light.
Okay. Right? Mm-hmm.
And so in theory, that means that there are an infinite number of colors because there are an infinite number of wavelengths between each of those primary colors we said, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think the wavelength for red is it's something like 550 okay, red's wavelength is 564 to 580 nanometers, right?
Okay.
Green is 534, 545, and blue is 420 to 440. But in between all of those wavelengths and adding each of those wavelengths together, you can, in theory, make colors that you may not have ever, you will never see them physically, but they should exist.
Okay.
Right? Now, the thing, though, with light, with a wave of light, is that before quantum mechanics, we thought that that was an infinitely breakable unit, right? So there was no, like, what do you do if you cut an infinitely long wave in half? You get two more infinitely long waves,
mm-hmm.
right? And so you never actually get to the end. You just can keep separating them and separating them until you get to, you know, you never get to anything. And what Schrodinger and others working in quantum mechanics found was that actually these waves become separated out into discrete particles. And so you could actually break up a wave or a wave particle into its individual pieces. And so the idea then of, well, what combination of these pieces give you red? What combination of these pieces gives you blue? And then also the philosophical questions of, does redness have any physical meaning past our perception of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's like, George, you're laughing.
Yeah.
That is like the douchebag freshman philosopher question, right?
Exactly.
That like
yeah.
everyone that jerk at the party smoking skunk weed with an acoustic guitar is like, you know, man, like my green might not even be your green, man. Right? Like that's like the whole thing. But that's like, it's ridiculous because it actually is a much more fundamental problem than you think of, right?
Right.
So for instance, if red light is like, okay, red paint is a pigment, it's a molecule, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we can put that molecule into water and make a red color. Well, is it the molecule itself that's red? Is it the mixture of the things? If we looked at that molecule under a microscope, would we see it as red?
Mm-hmm.
No, we wouldn't, right? It's just atoms.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So what color then do each of those atoms have?
It's that thought experiment of the person in the room that's completely black and white that learns everything about the color red. You know, like you were saying, it's wavelength, what particles it's made up of, and then they leave the room and they see red for the first time. Did they gain any more knowledge of it? Or
exactly.
Or what 100%. Happened there? And, I mean, I feel like as far as I got with it, that's a question with no current answer.
No, absolutely not.
You
well,
know,
and it ends up being it ends up being really important in the philosophy of science because actually a lot of so the reason why one of the reasons why Schrodinger is considered to be so important to science is that he developed the first really good reduction or was part of the really good reduction between a lower science and a higher science. What I mean by that mm-hmm. is like, so we know, like, let's take biology and chemistry, for example. We know that the motion of an animal is determined by the electrical impulses that come from its brain.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Right? And we know that the brain works a certain way. But we have no way of actually getting from, if I have these initial conditions of the molecules or atoms or electricity in the brain, I will get this action from this animal.
Right.
Right. Or even this cell. Like, forget animal. We can't even describe how a cell will react. Right. We can't predict that. And so there is a gap in our knowledge. And it ends up in the most common expression of this. And my listeners are like so sick of hearing about this, I bet. But whatever, listeners, it's the mind body problem. Right. Or we
right.
just can if our brain, if you were able to build a brain in a lab, would that brain have consciousness? right?
Right.
Consciousness is a property that can't, like, our brain, our mind seems to be greater than the sum of the parts that make up the mind, which is all that goo that our brain is.
Mm-hmm. Right. I like the idea of Phi, and that there's just different levels of consciousness, and it's based on the complexity of
the system?
Of the system, and that you can't have, like rushing nesting doll systems. Like, you have to have one overall system. Like, you can't have, you know, me, Antony, and you be one system. We all have to be discrete systems.
Right. I really like the idea. I like that idea too, generally. My preferred, I guess, idea is the supervenient model, where there are things that, like you said, come about from complex systems that aren't necessarily part of the individual pieces, right? So, like, there is some interaction between atoms that can create a force, and that force wouldn't exist normally, right? Like, that would be a very simple version of supervenience actually working.
Okay.
So this is a very long-winded explanation for... Colors is one of the most simple versions of that that you can explain to someone. If you kept breaking apart a red brick into its individual pieces all the way down till you got to atoms, at what point would you lose the redness of the pieces?
Okay.
Right.
Right? And so that is kind of the question that, part of the question that Schrodinger was so interested in, generally. But, of course, he was also, like, much better at optics than I am.
Mm.
So it gets a lot more complicated.
That was a great way to explain it to somebody, though, who doesn't have any basis past a high school education.
So
I'm like, no, I get that. That makes sense.
So basically what Schrodinger said was that basically that the idea of color being composed of an infinite line of color space is not correct. Instead, the idea of there being like individual primary colors or a bunch of different primary colors or whatever are basically the same idea.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so that was kind of where he worked. And it is very relatable to his work in quantum mechanics, because he was basically showing the same, or working in the same idea kind of field, where this thing that we thought was a continuous, never break apartable line is actually composed of these smaller pieces that are the fundamental parts of matter. You know, and well, at least we thought so then.
Right.
Now it's gotten more complicated. The deeper we go, the weirder crap gets. Anyways, okay, so we got this dude and his weird ideas.
Yeah, he was a kook. He did all kinds of fun stuff that doesn't make sense to me. Like, he addressed the problems of, like, genetics. He had, like, these theories on, like, unified field theory. He was just, like, you know, Schrodinger's cat. He was just this incredibly brilliant scientist.
I feel like everyone says Schrodinger's cat and they think one thing and it's really another thing.
What do you mean? I don't know what
the other thing is. Let me put it that way. But I have a sneaking suspicion that the thing everyone thinks it is not correct.
Oh, how they, like, have this weird perception of, like, the multiverse with it. That, like, kind of a thing. Like, they don't fully understand what it actually means. I've seen that. Like, people that have, like, kind of a misunderstanding about it.
Like, like, a cat doesn't just magically appear in a box.
Right.
It's actually a much more evil experiment that he thought of setting up. It's, how would you guys describe Schrodinger's cat? Like, what do you think that tells us?
I want to hear Toddy.
You want to hear me explain it?
Yeah.
You're so, I know. I'm like,
I want to put you completely 100% on the spot.
Okay.
Seriously, man.
Okay, so
she's looking up Wikipedia. I'm letting you off the hook.
I feel like I need to make sure I don't mess up. No, I'm just kidding. I will not cheat.
Very good. You went back to the
George is gonna narrate everything.
Goodness.
I'm really proud of you.
My husband keeps me honest.
I foresee a spot on the couch tonight. a cold, lonely room. Oh my goodness. Yeah.
We have too much audio to edit for him to be on the couch.
Yeah. Oh, okay. All right. So we're good. Oh, phenomenal. Good.
So my understanding of Schrodinger's cat, it's been actually a minute since I have really gotten into this with you, but I feel like Schrodinger's cat is the one where he's in the box and not at the box at the same time, right? Like, that's the whole thought experiment.
See, I'm going to totally duck the question and say that it has to do with the observer effect, and that
it's like if a tree falls, if nobody's around to hear the tree fall.
Not really, just like we can't, there's no way for us to measure something without affecting it.
Yes. Okay, that is, so you're both close. You're both really close. It is the observer effect. So it's kind of a simple way for them to explain how weird things are at the quantum mechanical scale.
Mm-hmm. Like the light that's hitting the thing that allows me to see it is actually moving it in some way.
Okay. So the perfect example of this is what's known as the slit experiment, or the foil slit experiment. And so basically what this was, imagine you're shooting tennis balls through a film or through a wall.
Mm-hmm.
And that wall has a dot, like a hole where someplace on the wall. And so you're shooting tennis balls towards this wall and there's a hole. And if you were going to actually forget tennis balls, let's say they're paintballs. You're shooting paintballs at a wall, and behind the wall is like another white wall.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah. if you were shooting at like a random way, so you were shooting at every point on that wall, behind the wall on that white surface, what would you expect to see? You would expect to see a dot, like a circle of paint, right, where those paintballs were being able to break through the wall where that hole was.
Right.
Right? What they and so that should work with electrons too. And so instead of, or photons. And so instead of using a paintball, you use an electron or a photon, you shoot it, and the hole that you've made is really small, almost towards the size of the electron itself. And behind that that piece of filter, you put a photo or electrical luminescent film. So for instance, when a photon or a wave of light hits that film, it'll brighten up.
Okay.
Right?
Right.
And so what they found was, if you actually do that with electrons or photons, what you actually end up with on the other side is a ring pattern. You don't get a circle, or you don't get a single spot where these electrons have moved through. You get what appears to be a wave pattern. So there's like, imagine like, you know, like a target, how that looks?
Right.
You end up getting that image. So instead of getting just the one dot, you end up getting a like a circle within a circle within a circle within a circle.
Okay.
And they were kind of like, well, what the hell is going on?
Mm-hmm.
That was and my so what first was thought. Happening
and so what was happening was, and if you remove the film and just shoot a straight beam of electrons or make that hole a little bit bigger, you actually get a straight, like, you get what you expect.
Mm-hmm.
And so what they ended up finding was, by actually limiting the possible positions of the quantum particle, they forced it to become a wave as opposed to a particle. Okay.
Okay.
And the reason that this happens is that we cannot simultaneously measure the position or the momentum of a quantum particle. It's called Heisenberg's uncertainty principle.
Okay.
And the reason that happens is, like, let's take electrons. Electrons are constantly moving at a super fast speed.
Right.
They're constantly moving. And so they exist within, like, areas where they're likely to be. Right? So we think, like, okay, there's a 99% chance that this electron will be in this area, but we can't know that it's there. We just have to say it's probably there.
Right. That's why they got rid of the rings and replaced it with
exactly
the cloud,
why they
right?
use orbitals now. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And so for us to know where it is at any point, we have to change the momentum. Or for us to know the momentum at any point, we have to know the position.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't know both of them simultaneously without changing how the particle is behaving.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense?
Yeah.
It makes
kind of.
It makes sense. I don't know if I could explain it again, but like. Okay. Well, but
hey,
I get
you know,
it.
We're good then. So the whole point of this experiment was to say, the way that we have to treat these particles as if they have both momentum and position, but we can't actually check that they do.
Right.
Right.
So our math has to account for both possibilities of what it can be.
Right.
That makes sense.
Of what those positions can be. So for Schrodinger's cat, what his experiment was you have a cat inside of a box, and in the box is a vial of poison that if the vial breaks open, the cat will die. And so this vial of poison is linked up to a machine that will crack the vial if a photon hits the like a sensor on it. And then we have a photon releasing agent, some kind of radioactive material, in the box with the cat. We cannot know if the cat will be killed or not by the poison. So the cat, For all intents and purposes, the cat is at any point both alive or dead.
Right.
And we won't know if the cat is alive or if it's dead unless we open up the box to observe that experiment.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so it's the same idea. We will not know if an electron is at a certain position unless we change its momentum by kind of opening the box, so to speak.
Now, in the 1920s, they did not have photon detecting equipment that would have made that experiment
well,
a possibility,
that was the whole point,
right?
It was theoretical.
That was
right?
Theoretical.
It was like,
he didn't kill a bunch of cats, right?
No, they never made these. Yeah, they never made any of these machines. But no, actually, we did. We had we've had the technology to. Marie Curie is one of the people that developed the first ability to detect radioactivity, right? And so, and so some of the ways that we detected radioactivity were really simple. Like, you could measure the heat in a room, right? It's going to get hotter the more radioactive something is. That literally happens. Or just that phosphorescent paper, like, you know, like film, like film paper, right? Like you would use in a camera. That is the kind of film that they would use for these experiments because it'll lighten up when a photon hits it.
That makes perfect sense.
And that's been around for a long time. So they had simple ways of measuring it. But some of these things, like the electron, we didn't know that the electron was a real thing. Like, we had never seen an electron cloud until, like, 1998, maybe? Wow. It was always just, like, a theoretical thing, but... You know, I mean, the proof is kind of in the fact that everything in our universe, like, works. Everything that we build based on these ideas totally works fine, pretty much. So, you know.
Yeah, that's one of those things where I'll believe it when I see it doesn't really make
no.
any sense.
No, it stops working once you get past, like, 100 nanometers, right? Yeah. Like, it stops being working. Yeah. So anyway, so this guy was like a huge influence on science. He actually, it was interesting you brought up the genetics thing.
Mm-hmm.
He actually is credited by one of the people that won the Nobel Prize for finding the shape of DNA. Schrodinger actually talked about some, you know, fundamental molecule of biology in one of his books, and this professor who did develop the DNA double helix, Watson, said that it was Schrodinger's book, The Secret of Life, that gave him the inspiration to look for that molecule.
Wow.
Wow.
Which is really cool. Yeah. So, like, sometimes people's just, like, random fanciful ideas end up being the basis of an entire field of science. So, you know, it's good. That's why you should write everything down, scientists. Like, keep journals. You never know what you'll discover.
Totally. Wow.
It's crazy.
Yeah. All right. So
to have that kind of influence off of just kind of like, just jot this down.
Some of the most important ideas came about that way. It's really funny. Like some of like, you know, like you have to wonder like what were on some of the napkins Tesla threw away, Right? Right. Like, what did he develop? Yeah.
Well, especially what did him, he... too, because he kept so much of his work.
I'm guessing a lot more about the pigeon. And so much of it was destroyed,
too. Danny probably talked a lot about that pigeon.
Yeah, you'd have to probably sift through a lot of notes about pigeons.
Right. And you know, the number three and how afraid he was of it. And like, yeah, he loved it. Yeah, it was good stuff, man.
That's all those scientists we've been talking about all have little dirty bits of history. That's what's so funny. Like, scientists could not behave.
No, they were all bad. Well, they were all these... It was this... It's really interesting because one thing with my show, at least, that always comes up is this idea of, like, the sciences and the occult almost being mixed together in a weird way during this time period. You know, so you had, like, Aleister Crowley and stuff was hanging out with some of the top scientists. Yeah, exactly, right? Like, hanging out with these scientists, and the whole idea is that you get to a certain point where I think people want atheism and science to kind of go hand in hand. And in some ways, I guess you can make the case that they sort of do, but on the other hand, you have scientists like Newton or even Schrodinger or other scientists, Einstein at the time, who believed that it was all part of, you know, kind of digging apart or finding God's plan, right? And so it's interesting, this link between immorality or the throwing away of old moral ideas when you're in a science, because in science you're sort of you're going back and looking at these people who have been persecuted throughout history and at some times, right?
Oh yeah.
And seeing that, you know, well, the moral standing of the time maybe was kind of silly, you know? But it's true in philosophy too. I mean, Kant, right? Kant was like a horrible misogynist.
He's our favorite, too. We love Kant.
He's ridiculous. Like, you know, he died without, like, ever holding hands with a woman or whatever.
Right.
Like,
right.
You know, ridiculous. Or, you know, I mean, it's all fascinating. No, I mean, that's why I thought this would be a good episode, because, yeah, scientists have always had a rough edge to them in some cases.
It's like they were rock stars before rock stars were rock stars.
In a way, yeah.
Sort of, they were very well-known people. They were talked about a lot. You know, they lived these crazy lives. They were, like, the famous people of, you know, before you had movies and, like, before theater was traveling all over the place, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, now we're just a bunch of nerds.
I don't know. I mean, Neil deGrasse Tyson is on my wall.
He's pretty badass.
He's pretty cool. He's pretty cool. Listen, that is my ultimate goal with the show. I don't even want to make any money. I just want to be... given the ability to do experiments on TV. That's it. You don't even have to pay me. Just give me the lab coat.
Please.
Ridiculousness. Oh, all right. Cool. All right. So Schrodinger's, I guess his personal life was a little bit interesting.
It was. He couldn't keep it in his pants.
Oh, no.
He couldn't.
Just like his cat. He had to observe it. He didn't know if it was there or not. That's what was going on.
Yeah.
Well,
he did
it's
a
interesting.
Lot of observing.
Well, oh my goodness.
What's interesting about him, though, is he claims to have been polyamorous, which is legit, you know, as long as you talk to your partner about it, it's fine. But it seems like he had this really, really bad...
I'm Eliza, and I need you to listen to me. Have you ever felt so much that you don't know where to put it all, and you wonder if anyone would notice if you screamed? Because you want to. Scream for the ones they've hurt, the ones they've taken. Scream for yourself. These are my words, my story from my perspective, because I know you'll hear other versions, because I want you to have a chance to believe mine. Or at least hear it. If you're getting this, it's already over. But if one of you listens, really listens, it won't be for nothing.
What would you even call that?
He was like polyamorous for like 3 months at a time.
No, he was polyamorous pretty consistently. But like what happened to him is there was this girl he used to babysit, which is creepy right there. And when she grows up to the ripe old age of 17 and he's 25, they're like in love. They decide to get engaged. And her parents are like, what are you doing? No, he's poor. He's, you know, ridiculous. Absolutely not.
Talking about dead cats.
Yeah, just all that nonsense. He's not making sense at all. Who is this guy? And he's so in love with her. He's like, I'm going to give up my career in science. I'll go, like, get a job at, like, a, I think it was, like, a linoleum factory or something like that. Like, he was like, I'm going to go get, like, a regular job and marry you because I love you so much. And her parents were like, you know what? It's 1913 in Austria. You're a teenager. Calm down. You're not marrying this guy. And they break it off. And that, like, devastates him. Like, he's never really the same after that. He was completely depressed, just, you know, life was over this woman.
Wow.
And it seemed to really just kind of change him. Like, as you read about, you know, how his life was going and the decisions he was making, like, after that happened, he basically, like, because he kept really, really detailed journals and diaries, he expressed that he was really put off to marriage after that. Like, he was like, it's this, like, bourgeois necessity. It's this, like, necessary evil. I'm not really a big fan of it. And you can kind of see that after what happened, because his parents were like, or her parents were like, no, he's not good enough for you. You know, so he has this whole view of marriage of it being this just, like, fake, bougie, societal thing. And so, you know, he goes all hipster on it. And he's like, that's a bunch of crap. I'm never getting married. So when he's 32, he gets married.
Sure, yeah.
Because, you know.
Everything looks silly and bougie as a young man. Yeah. Right.
Totally. It's like, I'm never going to give in to the man, corporate. Blah, blah, blah. But he totally does, because everybody does. So he marries.
Although, good call on her parents. Because instead of Schrodinger, we would have had, like, the world's best linoleum manufacturer.
Yeah, so they
had to do this. You know, so they did the world a service without even knowing they did.
That's a great way to look at it. Yeah. So he's 32, and he marries this cute 23-year-old, and he's completely turned off by his wife instantly. She's totally in love with him, and I think that's why they actually got married, is because he's like, oh, she's such a tomboy, she's so gross, I don't like her, she's just becoming even more masculine as she gets older, and she's just like, oh my god, I love him, he's so smart, he's so hot, he has this great personality, like, he's the full package. So,
thanks, baby.
What are you saying about me?
Oh my goodness.
How are you going to save that?
Well, how am I going to save? You've gotten girlier.
Thank you. <God. laughs> So he's like, no big deal. I'll just have, like, a polyamorous marriage. She's not going to really fight me on it. And she didn't. She was totally cool with it. She slept around with people she wanted to sleep around with. He slept around with people he wanted to sleep around with. It was totally open. It was cool. They were in Zurich at the time, and it was actually pretty liberal. Like, they were kind of like, eh, no big deal. You know, people might get their, like, feelings hurt and a little bit jealous, but it's fine. It was pretty progressive. Like, they had kind of reached that, like, sexual revolution a la Kinsey years before Kinsey started doing his thingy in America.
Was he well-known at this time?
Who? Kinsey?
Schrodinger.
Or Schrodinger? He was getting there, yeah. Like, fairly.
He was making a name for himself.
Yeah, he was, for sure. Like, he was starting to get, like,
because this is pre-Nobel Prize, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So, he kept a record of all of the names of his lovers.
Of course he did.
Because he's a scientist. Of course he did. For
research.
Just in case.
Just in case. A scatter plot.
He might forget.
Oh my goodness.
There were so many. He was such a playboy. He can't possibly just remember all of those names.
Right.
So he made a list. And he has a little code next to each affair, or the denouncement. Is what he called it, like, to kind of, like, keep track, like, okay, we're sleeping together, like, at this time, I'm breaking up with them here, this is the last time we hung out. He's, like, managing his women. Yeah, it's total scatterplot.
Yeah, seriously.
Line of best fit.
Totally. And he did this for years and years and years, forever. He had, like, a ton of mistresses. Three gave him a daughter each.
And we don't mean just like hand it to my daughter.
Okay.
Oh, all right. Thanks for clarifying.
Yeah.
I was confused. Yeah. So he's just, you know, going around just banging a bunch of chicks. And in 1934, the Nazi party's like, you know, doing their thing in Germany where he's hanging out and he's not down with that anti-Semitism business they have going on. So sure. He's like, I'm going to dip from Germany, go become a fellow at Oxford. It'll be perfect.
He saw the writing on the wall.
Yeah, damn, dude.
And so, speaking of the Nobel Prize, mm-hmm. after he arrives, he receives that. And it didn't really work out very well for him and his unusual family. Because by this point, he had what they were calling an unconventional domestic arrangement, where he was sharing living quarters with two women, which were his wife, and then his little side piece, and then he had a baby with his side piece. So it was really complicated, and all these people that he's trying to get a job with, like at Oxford and Princeton, are like, wait, what? Because he's like, right. Oh, hey, what's up? Here are the women that I sleep with. Can we move in today?
My wife and my friend.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She's the nanny.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There it is. Geez. But he's so
if
just
only
like.
He was that sly.
No, that's what yeah. I was going to say, too, is like, and he's like a scientist. He's not like the most like, you know, suave, like fast on his feet kind of a guy, like on his toes.
He likes to contemplate.
He saw no problem with it. He's like, I don't know why people are upset. I don't know why anybody thinks this is weird. I'm the only one doing it. It should be totally normal. But like his expectations for what people were going to be okay with, he was always like shocked that people were like not down with like the I have many wives thing.
Sure.
Yeah, like really you just solved the problem for him. Here's my wife and our nanny.
Yeah,
but
like,
he never
nanny.
Thought to say that. He was just like, here's me and however many wives I have at the time.
Right, yeah, this is me and my lady.
Yeah, exactly.
And everybody, like all of like the deans and all of his bosses, their eyes just get all big, the eyebrow raises, they're like, what? And it's tough for him, but he finally gets a job. And then in 1938, he's like, okay, let's go to Ireland and go hang out there. And they have to personally ask the prime minister, who fortunately for him was a mathematician. So he was already like, oh my God, Schrodinger, you're so cool. And he's like, no problem. Let me grant you a visa for your wife, you, and your girlfriend.
Oh, wow.
And come live, all three of you, in this cute little house in Dublin.
That's so interesting. It's such a weird thing to think that, like, I mean, you know, I say that, but then I think, like, we're still kind of. We're still politicizing romantic relations with people, however the hell you want it to be.
Right.
But, damn, that's craziness.
It is.
So they ended up moving to Ireland.
He did. He ended up moving to Ireland.
Okay.
See, the thing that shocked me is, like, when's the last time we had a prime minister of anything that was a mathematician?
Or
like
oh,
a
I don't
physicist.
Know.
Very true.
You know? I think that'd be nice.
Actually, the president of China, I don't think this current one, I think the one previous to him was a chemical engineer, actually, which is pretty cool.
That's pretty cool.
But, yeah, no, the United States, we haven't had an academically inclined leader since maybe Woodrow Wilson.
I was going to say, yeah. I mean, everybody's just a career politician. That's just what they do here. You're not military, career politician. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
But it is stuff. Interesting how you talked about like the politicizing there with like relationships, because if you think about it, it's like his work has nothing to do with his personal life, especially his wife was not in the dark about it. You know what I mean? Like she was like, yeah, for sure. No big deal.
Right. It's interesting. I mean, you know, there are other famous stories, of course, of, again, I think this comes with the idea of scientists being. There's always been that idea in history and in pop culture, I guess more so than history really, of kind of the eccentric scientist who, you know, will lose his hat on the train or something and accidentally discover a new particle, or like, you know, they're right. Like almost Mr. Magooing their way through life.
Yes.
And my wife says that's how I do things actually, so I shouldn't really make this joke possibly, but. You know, and they always, there have been a lot of scientists who, again, because their work is oftentimes going against the prevailing notions of the time, and therefore they have more pragmatic or maybe unconventional ideas compared to everyone else around them, that they end up with these sometimes unconventional unconventional personal lives or interests, right? I mean, you have Alan Turing, who was famously, you know, famously homosexual, and, you know, was eventually chemically castrated for that.
Right.
You have other scientists throughout history who, you know, it was kind of a open secret, you know. And there is really a long history of scientists who, you know, it's funny, the mathematician who developed differential equations, at the end of his life began painting his nails pink, and he had these giant granite blocks brought to his home and all these other weird eccentric kind of things, and no one thought anything of it. But if there was a, you know, there were similar mathematicians who would, you know, be confirmed bachelors and living with their boyfriends, and people would find out, and it was a huge scandal.
Right.
You know, it's so funny, like, the things that we thought of as scandalous or continue to think of as scandalous. You know, it's really, truly wacky.
It is, but, totally.
Yeah. That's interesting, though. Damn, so Schrodinger was just planting seed around town.
Now Dublin, specifically the town.
Dublin, okay, he's doing great. Doing well.
He was doing well lots in Zurich, smart... now he's doing well in Dublin.
He's doing well in Dublin. Lots of smart grandbabies, yeah. That's good.
Yeah. He did well everywhere he went, it seemed, and he did really, really well with young women. It always seemed like he just kind of had that thing.
What do you know?
It brought me back to what happened to him when he was 25.
Right.
Too, it was just like this lifelong trend, and I feel like that's been touched on in many works of literature, where like something like that happens to you, like with your first love, and that like affects you in your romantic life for the rest of your life.
Right. Right. You know what? It also too, like before we started on these scientist stories, whatever, we were talking about old Hollywood and even modern Hollywood. Right. Like, there's something intrinsically, like, science has not been immune to the Me Too movement or the horrors of, you know, what a lonely man with power can do to harm other people. You know, there are all these stories of professors who end up marrying their graduate students. I'll never forget. We had such an uncomfortable lecture at my university. I don't even remember the guy's name, but he was telling this story about how he developed this new technology, and he was like, you know, and my grad student who was working on it at the time was just, you know, the sexiest, most wonderful woman I'd ever seen. And everyone in the room was just like,
what?
And then he was like, and then I marry her. And everyone was like, oh, ha, ha, ha. And, you know, started clapping. And it's like, why are you fucking clapping? She was like 20 years old and he was like 50. That's fucked. Like, that's not cool, guys. Well, you know, like the idea of power, these power dynamics, I think, you know, as we go back and now look at the way that societal power interacts and affects our relations with other people, we're going to find more and more heroes to tear down.
Oh, absolutely. You know? I agree 100%.
It's interesting, though, that a lot of, you know, thankfully, a lot of my philosophical heroes were, like, asexual and weird.
Right? Yeah.
So that's good. So thank God. Woo! You know, oh, my goodness.
Categorical imperative.
Yes, we're all good. can't get into a sexual harassment deal if you never have
sex. Yeah, exactly.
Perfect. No, but it is true though. Like, I'm really interested to see how it does actually affect and change academic science as it is now, because there is, even outside of the dynamic between, you know, whatever, like romantic relationships between professors and students, or even grad students and students or whatever, there's also the idea of the power dynamic between just the professor and the student themselves, in the sense that for all intents and purposes, grad students are basically servants.
Right.
You know, like, they don't have lives. Right. So anyways, that's fascinating, though. So Schrodinger, so did they end up staying in Ireland?
They did. And he, of course, found another woman In Ireland, because
just
why?
Had to whip out that Nobel Prize.
is that what he was calling it?
right. <He's... laughs> I was going to say he was polishing it on the train, but then you said, is that what he's calling it? Now it makes a whole new level of strangeness. I don't think it was that bad.
He did very well in Dublin.
Yeah, he did great. He hooked up with this former married actress named Sheila May, knocked her up, and then wrote in his diary, this is a quote, "I am the happiest man in Dublin, probably in Ireland, probably in Europe."
So scientific.
Whoa! Nice. he had a hedge.
Yeah.
Make it a completely obtuse claim. Right. Interesting. Wow.
So, you know, he just loves her so much. She's so amazing until he gets sick of her and moves on like he's one to do. And you keep seeing this pattern throughout his life, and it's really interesting. So I, of course, had to look more into that. And one of the biographers has this theory that he needed this, temptuous sexual adventure to inspire all of the discoveries that he was making. Kind of like what we were talking about, which I thought was really interesting, and it's kind of a cop-out.
I was going to say...
Right. It's for science. You don't understand.
He's such a douche. Like, he writes in one of his lovers, like, he goes about the many, 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 many women that he was, you know, doing the mattress dance with. He goes, "Poor things. They have provided for my life's happiness and their own distress. Such is life." And I'm just getting this. Jeez. Yeah. So the more that I'm reading all of this, guys.
A little bit dismissive.
Well, because that's the thing about people that are like fairly recent additions to history in a way, you know?
Right.
It's not like, you know, looking back things for hundreds and hundreds of years where it's like, well, we assume because of this and that and the other and like secondary sources.
Yeah. The
like,
farther you go back, the more you can excuse. Like, the guy wasn't Genghis Khan.
No, it's just like you actually have his words.
Right.
You have his words right there. So I'm reading this guy's words and I'm getting an impression of him as opposed to Genghis Khan, where I haven't really found a whole lot of diary entries for that guy.
not a big writer.
He never updated his blog. I don't know what he was doing during that whole time.
Didn't have a lot of time. You know, his hands were always busy. Zanga. Genghis the dork. XX. Yeah. That's ridiculous. You know, it is interesting, actually, there's always this big thing whenever we find out that our heroes are sort of less than, right? And Schrodinger is not a particular hero of mine necessarily, but there are some of these people you look back on in history and you're like, oh my goodness, they were terrible people.
Oh yeah.
Right?
Oh yeah.
So like, I'm sure there are plenty of people who have read, they have this ideal of Einstein, and then they read one of his biographies, and they're like, "Oh no!
Oh, he was such a tool. He was not nice.
No, he was not a great dude. You know, or even there. You know, I mean, there's just myriad examples, whatever. And yeah, you're totally right. The closer they are. It makes me worry about Bill Nye's diaries.
Oh, no, I've already, like, put up that, like,
totally.
What would you even call
I've
that?
I've scratched him off the list already.
No, I'm putting up, like, walls to guard myself. Like, I kind of just assume everybody probably has that stuff who's famous.
You know what, just
well
that new show is enough of a strike against him.
He's done enough.
Oh, goodness.
So, Schrodinger is this pretentious, just douche with an ego, and I'm like, what is it that's making him this way, you know, besides like that whole incident when he was younger. So I'm reading, and I find this article that's published in 1990 from the New York Times, and I'm like, oh my god, now everything makes sense. He drives a BMW.
Damn it! I knew there was something I didn't like about that Schrodinger.
Oh, okay, now I get it.
Perfect.
So, oh, man. That's the story of Schrodinger.
I mean, that biographer is so so ridiculous, saying that he needed what's the quote here? Tempestuous sexual adventures to inspire those great discoveries. That's like,
I mean, seriously.
That's like saying,
seriously.
Before I edit this audio, babe, I need a tempestuous sexual adventure.
Don't do that.
Like, before
different.
You record.
Have...
Wait, does that work?
No.
Does that work for you? Oh my goodness.
It does when you do a sex podcast, but I wouldn't recommend it to anybody else who isn't married to their editor.
What a hard, I mean, really though, it's so funny, like, that is such a cop out, such a stupid excuse for being horrible to other people.
Right.
Like, I mean, I don't know. You know what it reminds me of is there's that this book, not a lot of like non-philosophers have read this book, but Either Or by Soren Kierkegaard.
Oh yeah.
And he I don't think it's A, I think it's B, the character B, where his whole thing is like going around and getting into engagements with young women, marrying them, bedding them, and then leaving.
Right.
Right. And his whole story is about this idea of like these dalliances that he has, and it's all for this, the thrill of that momentary taste of love, and then he leaves and does none of the hard work. Right. And it makes me think that Schrodinger was probably a very unhappy person generally.
Yeah, totally.
You know? Which like explains his love of math, I guess. Because we're all very sad people that love math. Interesting. Well, that's really cool.
I know, it's super fascinating, and that's why I love what we do, like with researching what we do, is because if you've listened to my show, like I don't go extremely into the academics of a lot of what I'm talking about. I like to talk about how these people's personal lives influence their decisions and history because of who they were and what they were doing. Because everybody's a person. Everybody acts on their emotions. There isn't anybody who like truly, truly acts selflessly. And that's what's so sure. fascinating, is because you see how these people are shaping our society from just the get-go. And how everybody really is a person. Everybody has some of those like weird quirks, and I feel like it kind of brings more humanity to that. So, yeah, it's so much fun to learn about all that stuff. He just opened my eyes to so much. I was like, this all makes perfect sense. I feel like I have such a better understanding.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. Oh man. Good stuff. Well, thank you for that story.
Oh, thank you for letting us share
really
it. It's one of our favorites.
Oh, no problem. Come on. So, okay. So the story that I brought to the table here is a lot less psychological and a lot more, about the penis.
Okay.
Which is easily the funniest organ on the body.
I can't argue with that.
So this story begins, actually since the beginning of time. So
it's a short one.
So male erectile dysfunction has been, you know, we have these jokes about Viagra being, this, you know, it's ridiculous. Viagra is like covered by health insurance when, you know, breast cancer screenings aren't,
right.
And you know, like all this bullshit, whatever. And it's a huge industry, right? The Viagra makes Pfizer so much money every year. You know, it's hilarious how much money it makes. And it was discovered by accident,
right?
It was found initially in a study for, so the drug itself is called sildenafil.
Okay.
And initially, it was under development for high blood pressure. And what they found was they were giving it to these old men who had high blood pressure, and those old men were getting boners. and then they were like, Doc, I don't know what's going on, but I love this.
They're like,
pill.
I'm not complaining,
you
but
know?
Is it okay?
Yeah. So this is a quote from one of the first academic studies of sildenafil. For this treatment. So sildenafil, an orally active type 5 cyclic GMP specific phosphodiesterase inhibitor for the treatment of penile erectile dysfunction. So whatever, it's just they take it orally and it blocks this specific thing and it causes you to get a boner. So this is a quote from this quote: Moreover, in a clinical study of 12 patients with erectile dysfunction without an established organic cause, we have shown sildenafil to enhance the erectile response, duration, and rigidity of erection to visual sexual stimulation. Hilarious. So that is in a scientific study. Now, so the story actually that I wanted to talk about was the actual history of this idea of a treatment for erectile dysfunction. So being impotent, like being a impotent man in a relationship was actually at one point considered a crime in certain societies.
Right.
So in 16th, 17th centuries in France, it was considered a crime. And it has almost always been a legal grounds for divorce.
There you go.
So, because again, back when marriage was a primarily religious, but also an economical thing.
Right.
If you couldn't make heirs, then what was the point of getting married?
Right.
And so
it's not fun. That's for procreation.
Yeah. Right. No, it's completely for procreation.
It's the only reason.
Now
we need more little hands for the looms.
Oh! Now, initially what was kind of interesting was, so the United States has always had a long history of quack medicine,
of course.
Right? And so, there was a radio program by John R. Brinkley during the 30s, and he would say that there were ways to get rid of erectile dysfunction by implanting goat glands into the human body.
Where in the human body?
It's never made completely clear where in the human body. But that you could also inject yourself with mercurochrome, which is mercury chromium. Yeah!
Oh.
Not great. Not super great. And actually, one of the most famous scientists who did this kind of stuff was Serge Voronoff. What he did actually was he did a technique where he would graft the testicles of monkeys to human testicles in order to create human with, you know, to get rid of human erectile dysfunction, to get rid of impotence, to get rid of all that kind of stuff.
When you say graft.
Right?
Graft, like a skin graft.
So, so what I literally mean is you cut off a part of the tissue of, so it's actually very similar to how we do grafts now. You take, so this is the official transplantation of the monkey gland into a human. This from June 12th, 1920. What they would do is they would take very small slices of chimpanzee and baboon testicles.
Oh, this hurts already.
And implant them inside of the scrotum of the human.
Oh.
And the idea was that eventually this being within the scrotum would allow it to, what's the word? It would be allowed to fuse with the tissues of the human eventually.
Mm-hmm. Who is volunteering?
And so they're actually, it's actually hilarious. There are pictures of some of the animals that he grafted. So like there's a goat with a bunch of testicles grafted onto it and stuff. and so he tried this for all kinds of different things though. He didn't just try grafting, you know, testicles. He tried thyroid, he tried monkey ovaries into women, and the other way around. So one of his more interesting experiments was you transplant a human ovary into a female monkey, and then you try to inseminate that monkey with human sperm.
So he was reading a lot of Mary Shelley, and he wanted to be Frankenstein.
Pretty close to being Frankenstein, right?
Seriously.
Yeah, that is off-putting.
Oh.
Yeah. So, and none of his experiments showed any of the results that he claimed.
Thank
obviously
God.
Right? but he basically believed that there were glands within the body, and these glands would secrete hormones. So like, you know, I don't know if he actually called them hormones at the time, but basically this idea of that the testicle was another kind of gland that would release a hormone just like the thyroid gland.
See.
And so by transplanting that into a human, the idea was that you could kind of jumpstart the production of glands within humans, right?
Ooh.
He's actually relatively famous for being one of the scientists to do experiments on himself.
Oh, wow.
So he himself had ground up dog and guinea pig testicles injected under his skin.
Oh no.
Which did not stop him from aging the way that he thought.
Well, that's shocking. I'm very surprised.
Which is really interesting. So yeah, it's quite fascinating. So this guy was a nutcase.
So he believed that
implanting the glands from young animals into older animals or from one animal to another species could allow for kind of the reuptake or the kickstarting the systems in the human or this other animal to make them more vigorous. But it's pretty interesting.
Like, how far would he get until it was just like you couldn't tell which animal was which animal? Did he like start?
So he limited himself to just putting basically testicles into different parts of the animal.
So it was really just all about the testicles.
It was all testicles all the time with this guy, you know, all testicles all the time. Yeah, it's really interesting. And he actually had quite a bit of success during his lifetime. He was, he gave presentations in front of the International Congress of Surgeons in the UK. He had books at the time that were very well known. One of the funny things, there's a poem, I guess, by E.E. Cummings that talks about the famous doctor who inserts monkey glands in millionaires, which is quite interesting. So, yeah, it's good stuff. So all of this comes down to there was a huge interest in trying to create more vigor in older people, right? And it kind of goes along with this idea of anti-aging generally, mm-hmm. right? And one of the more interesting things that occurred with this whole idea, though, was the creation of a drug that was thought to increase sexual vigor. And that was what would become known as Viagra. But one of the more famous cases of this is a story of Professor G.S. Brindley, who this experiment happened in 1983. And I'm going to read from one of my favorite scientific, not really a paper, but a story. And the story is called How Not to Communicate New Scientific Information, a memoir of the famous Brindley lecture by Lawrence Klotz. And this is from 2005. And so this I'm going to just start from kind of the middle here. The lecture, which had an innocuous title along the lines of vasoactive therapy for erectile dysfunction, was scheduled as an evening lecture of the Urodynamic Society in the hotel in which I was staying. I was a senior resident, hungry for knowledge, and at the AUA I went to every lecture that I could. About 50 minutes before the lecture, I took the elevator to go to the lecture hall, and on the next floor, a slight, elderly-looking and bespectacled man, wearing a blue tracksuit and carrying a small cigar box, entered the elevator. He appeared quite nervous and shuffled back and forth. He opened the box in the elevator, which became crowded, and started examining and ruffling through the 35mm slides of micrographs inside. I was standing next to him and could vaguely make out the contents of the slides, which appeared to be a series of pictures of penile erection. I concluded that this was indeed Professor Brindley on his way to the lecture, although his dress seemed inappropriately casual. The lecture was given in a large auditorium with a raised lectern separating by some stairs from the seats. This was an evening program between the daytime sessions and an evening reception. It was relatively poorly attended, perhaps 80 people in all. Most attendees came with their partners, clearly on the way to the reception. I was sitting in the third row, and in front of me were about 7 middle-aged male urologists and their partners in full evening regalia. Professor Brindley, still in his blue tracksuit, was introduced as a psychiatrist with broad research interests. He began his lecture with aplomb. He indicated, hypothesized that injection with vasoactive agents into the corporal bodies of the penis might induce an erection. Lacking ready access to an appropriate animal model, and cognizant of the long medical tradition of using oneself as a research subject, he began a series of experiments on self-injection of his penis with various vasoactive agents, including papaverine, phentolamine, and several others. While this is now commonplace, at the time it was unheard of. I love that this was written in 2005, and the guy's like, people are always injecting their dicks with stuff. His slide-based talk consisted of his large series of photographs of his penis in various states of tumescence after injection with a variety of doses of phenolphthalein and papaverine. After viewing about 30 of these slides, there was no doubt in my mind that, at least in Professor Brindley's case, the therapy was effective. Of course,
George is on the floor right now.
Of course, one could not exclude the possibility that erotic stimulation had played a role in acquiring these erections, and Professor Brindley acknowledged this. The professor wanted to make his case in the most convincing style possible. He indicated that, in his view, no normal person would find the experience of giving a lecture to a large audience to be erotically stimulating or erection-inducing. He had, he said, therefore injected himself with papaverine in his hotel room before coming to give the lecture, and deliberately wore loose clothes, hence the tracksuit, to make it possible to exhibit the results. He stepped around the podium and pulled his loose pants tight up around his genitalia in an attempt to demonstrate his erection. At this point... I believe everyone else in the room, was aghast. I could scarcely believe what was occurring on stage. But Professor Brindley was not satisfied. He looked down skeptically at his pants and shook his head with dismay. Unfortunately, this doesn't display the results clearly enough. He then summarily dropped his trousers and shorts, revealing a long, thin, clearly erect penis.
Oh my god, he had to describe it.
There was not a sound in the room. Everyone had stopped breathing. But the mere public showing of his erection from the podium was not sufficient. He paused and seemed to ponder his next move. The sense of drama in the room was palpable. He then said with gravity, "I'd like to give some of the audience the opportunity to confirm the degree of tumescence." with his pants and his knees, he waddled down the stairs, approaching, to their horror, the urologists and their partners in the front row. As he approached them, erection waggling before him, four or five of the women in the front rows threw their arms up in the air, seemingly in unison, and screamed loudly. The scientific merits of the presentation had been overwhelmed, for them, by the novel and unusual mode of demonstrating the results. The scream seemed to shock Professor Brindley, who rapidly pulled up his trousers, returned to the podium, and terminated the lecture. This guy, he actually had a single author paper about these results, and, His lecture is one of the most famous in the history of science.
I'm sure.
Yeah. So I just love that this guy, the person writing this, was like, we got to put in there that it was.
No, that's what I was saying too. I was just like, gotta get the weird. Sure, we knew what that dick looked like.
Oh my goodness!
He was trying to demonstrate the timidity. Was that the word?
Tumescence. Which actually here, let me pull up here
I'm
a good.
Use that in everyday parlance.
It's a really good one. So tumescence is the quality or state of being tumescent or swollen.
Okay.
So he was like, everyone, come look how swole I am. Pretty gross.
If you ever like hurt your finger, I'm like, oh, it's very tumescent.
Oh, my long thin finger is very tumescent.
Oh, God.
Yeah. So that guy's work with vasodilators. Basically what they do is they make and that's the reason why initially they thought that Viagra would be good for the use of hypertension, mm-hmm. is that basically it would allow the blood's pressure to go down by removing the water within
right.
it. Right? And so the same idea, like it could either cause or stop blood pressure from rising, and so allow the flow of blood to other parts of the bodies where it wouldn't normally occur anymore. So anyways, a fascinating story in the history of science. Don't expect going to a science lecture will always be boring, folks.
Well, now I'm always going to expect a show.
Sometimes it can be truly horrible. Yeah, so that is my dirty
oh
story
my God,
of science.
That was beautiful. I have to let you know that I
Thank
haven't
you.
seen George laugh like that with that kind of reaction in a very long time. He was on the floor kicking his legs in the air, couldn't breathe.
Telling you, doing well. Doing well. So, folks, I hope you enjoyed this episode. It was a huge amount of fun for me to do. Tawny, George, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. That was
fun. Thank you for having us. It was such a blast.
Oh, my goodness.
Like that for a while.
It was super good. I'm telling you, I gotta have you guys come on here again.
Oh, we'd love to.
There are so many hilarious, weird stories about science out there. And, you know, sometimes this show gets pretty academic, but, you know, it's good. We can have a good time here. So I just wanted to give you another, you know, another little bit to tell us about your show. Tell us about this podience thing in your survey. I'd love to be able to get a bunch of people listening to the show to go out and, you know, hit up the survey to give you more info and stuff.
Thank
for
you
sure.
so much. So the survey that we're conducting is with the Orbital Jigsaw Network and Podience. And the survey is one of the biggest ones, if not the biggest one we've at least found, as far as getting a good sample size of information from both podcasters and podcast listeners. So it's on my Facebook page personally. It's on the Orbital Jigsaw Facebook page. And if you could fill that out, that would be wonderful. We're going to be sharing the results with everybody in the community so everybody can benefit from this information. It's something that we haven't seen done yet that we think could really help podcasters make a better community for the listeners, help listeners have more fun in the podcasting arena. So Orbital Jigsaw is our Facebook page, and we're also creating a group around that for podcasters that want to learn how to monetize, market their podcasts. It's all of some of the best podcasts, if not all of the best podcasts in the indie podcasting world right now. We're getting everybody involved in that, as well as listeners who can find specially curated shows and interact with the hosts that they love, find other shows that they like that are top quality, and we'd love to have you guys be a part of it.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much again. Guys, go out there, fill out the survey, check out the page, check out the Dirty Bits podcast. If you like this episode, I think you're going to like their show for sure. It's always a great time, so definitely one of my favorites. And Tawny, George, thank you again so
thank
much.
Thank you so much for having us. It was a blast.
No problem. And dear listeners, happy holidays, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, all of those days, all the big ones, all the little ones, all the ones out there that are possibly out there. Hope you have a good vacation. I know I am enjoying it by playing video games almost exclusively, so
that
it's pretty great.
Amazing.
Anyways, oh, it's so good.
Don't you know that you're a grown-up?
I'm a grown-up.
Me too.
Yep, me too. But you know, these days, being a grown-up can really suck.
Luckily, we're grown-ups who grew up in the coolest generation.
We had video arcades.
And also some of the best TV and movies ever made.
We lived the origin of awesome consumer electronics. The list goes on and on.
Yep, Generation X.
Exactly.
And we're Gen X Grown-Up.
Every week, the Gen X Grown-Up podcast explores media, tech, toys, games, and more from both yesterday and today.
Through the eyes of Generation Xers who absolutely love that stuff. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
Or find us on our website, GenXGrownUp.com. Life sucks as a grown-up. All right, I think that was good enough.
I hope so, man. I'm tired.
Who listens to a promo on a podcast and then goes and listens to a different podcast?
Right. I've never done it.
No. Right.